Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. Today we will journey to the center of the atom to find the smallest pieces of nature, the pieces from which everything we see around us is made. One of the greatest advances of science in the 20th century was discovering what these pieces are, how they interact, and how they determine the fate of stars, of the universe, and indeed, of everything in our lives. Since I am a high-energy particle physicist, I will be introducing you today to some of the dear members of my family. As usual, we have some images posted on my website that you'll want to watch while you're listening to the audio track, so open a second window, go to guidetothecosmos.com, click on the microphone icon, and pull up today's show, Journey to the Center of the Atom. So what about atoms? For 25 centuries, people debated whether or not atoms really did exist, namely, whether or not material objects were made of little teeny pieces. Many folks thought that matter was actually smooth and continuous, that if you were able to look deeply into the center of something like a wire, all you would ever see would be just more wire. These people thought that a wire could be cut into smaller and smaller pieces without any limits, and that no matter how small the pieces were, they would still simply just be wire. Whereas other people believed that if you looked deeply enough, if you cut it into a small enough piece, you would find that the wire was made of discrete little parts that all linked together to make a wire. The Greek philosopher and scientist Democritus is credited with being the first person to name these little parts. He called them atomos, a Greek word for uncuttable. Since no one actually had a microscope that was able to look deeply enough into the center of things, the debate about the existence of atoms continued as a purely philosophical discussion for about 2,500 years. And then, in 1905, Albert Einstein devised a method to prove that atoms really did exist. And when subsequent experiments confirmed his predictions, scientists around the world finally agreed that atoms were for real. Image number one is a sketch of an atom. It shows that atoms are really very simple. They're just balls that have only two parts, an inside and an outside. The inside is called the nucleus, and it has a positive electric charge. The outside is a cloud of electrons that has a negative electric charge. And at least as far as electricity is concerned, opposites really do attract. Positive charges attract negative charges, and that's what holds atoms together. And since we're all made of atoms, it's very convenient that they just don't fall apart. Now, my sketch really isn't drawn to scale, and in fact, there's no way that it could be, because the electron cloud is really about 100,000 times larger than the nucleus. So if we were to imagine enlarging an atom until the nucleus became the size of a golf ball, then the electron cloud would become over 2 miles across. But even though the nucleus is so teeny, it's the nucleus that dominates the entire atom. The nucleus has almost all of the atom's mass and energy, and it defines its characteristics. the nucleus will typically contain about 99.97% of all of the atom's mass. The nucleus can weigh thousands of times more than all the electrons combined. And the nucleus can have millions of times more energy that's extractable than the electron cloud. Nuclei really are something very special. They are trillions of times heavier than gold and millions of times harder than diamonds. The electrons, more or less, are just along for the ride. After 25 centuries, we now know that Democritus was right, that everything really is made of atoms. But what we call atoms are not uncuttable. Perhaps Democritus was wrong about that, or perhaps in our quest to search for the smallest parts, we used Democritus's word a bit too soon. Because atoms are not the smallest parts, as we will soon see. Indeed, atoms are easy to cut, that is, to tear off their electrons. And with even more energy, we can cut nuclei into pieces as well. Image number 2 shows what happens when you take a nucleus apart. Again, we find that a nucleus is composed of two types of parts, protons and neutrons. Each proton has a positive electric charge, and each neutron has zero charge. So it's the protons that give the nucleus the electric charge it needs to attract the electrons, and therefore to create an atom. So every atom has to have at least one proton in its nucleus. And most atoms have about the same number of neutrons as protons. The simplest atom is hydrogen. That only has a single proton in its nucleus. Atoms like carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen all have equal numbers of protons and neutrons. Carbon has 6 of each, nitrogen has 7 of each, oxygen has 8 of each. But as the atoms get heavier and heavier, you need more neutrons to keep the party together. So uranium has 92 protons and 146 neutrons. But protons are the most important part of any atom, and the number of them determines virtually all of the characteristics of that atom. Image number 3 shows the famous periodic table, which is an organized list of all of the elements that we know. Each element has different chemical and physical properties. The number of protons in any atom determines what element that atom is going to be. So, for example, gold is element number 79. It has 79 protons in its nucleus, while lead is element number 82 with 82 protons. What a difference three little protons make between lead and gold. Thus, atoms are made of three types of particles: electrons on the outside and protons and neutrons on the inside the nucleus. Now, are these particles the end of our quest for the smallest pieces of nature? Do these particles have smaller pieces inside them yet? Well, it turns out the answer is yes and no. To the best we can tell, and believe me, we've looked deeply inside these things, electrons have no internal parts. We say, therefore, that they are fundamental particles. Also, sometimes we say they are elementary particles, meaning that they're not made of anything else. Electrons are one end of our quest for the smallest of the small. But protons and neutrons are not elementary or fundamental. They do have internal parts, and we call those quarks. And some of those are illustrated in image number 4. Protons are made of 2 up quarks and 1 down quark, while neutrons are made of 2 down quarks and 1 up quark. Quarks are just the first of the strange names that we're going to encounter. We believe that quarks have no internal parts, and so they too are fundamental or, if you wish, elementary particles. Now, all elementary particles, and also all protons and neutrons, have a very special characteristic that is totally unlike anything that we are familiar with in the everyday macroscopic world. One strange aspect of their behavior is that all particles of any given type are exactly identical to all the other particles of that same type. So all electrons are exactly the same. Exactly the same. All protons are exactly the same, and all down quarks are exactly the same. Now, I don't mean that identical particles are just very similar, like identical twins, and I don't mean that scientists haven't yet built precise enough instruments to detect their differences. What I do mean is something much more than any of that. Nature herself cannot find any difference whatsoever between any two electrons. Quantum mechanics tells us that if there were any difference at all, even the slightest difference, no matter how minute, atoms would all collapse. The electrons would all fall into the lowest energy states, and it would be impossible for any molecules to be created, and life itself would not exist anywhere in the universe. Our existence is definitive proof that every electron is exactly identical to every other electron without any exception whatsoever. Nothing in our macroscopic world is so identical to anything else as our elementary particles. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are taking a journey to the center of the atom. Well, I'm very happy to tell you that our show has a new sponsor, CruiseDirect.com. So when you're planning your cruise, the best place to get the best prices and the best itineraries is CruiseDirect.com. You can choose your cruise by destination or by cruise line or by budget. Go to CruiseDirect.com, your online destination for cruising. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back, taking a journey today to the center of the atom. We have said so far that everything we see around us is made of atoms, which are made in turn of electron clouds surrounded by a minute but extremely massive central nucleus, which is made of protons and neutrons. And in turn, those two are made of up and down quarks. It turns out that there are actually a total of 6 different types of quarks. Some face up, some are at the top, some face down, some are at the bottom, some have charm, and some are more than a little strange. And I'm not kidding. Those are actually their real names. Up, Down, Charm, Strange, Top, and Bottom. The names really don't mean anything. Physicists just got tired of using Greek words and came up with all these fanciful names. Actually, no single quark is more charming or more strange than any of the others. There are innumerable different types of particles that can be made by combining various quarks together. But of all those combinations, only the ones that make protons and neutrons are long-lived. Protons and neutrons will last for tens of billions of years or more, while all the other combinations of quarks typically fall apart in much less than a trillionth of a second. It's a good thing that our atoms happen to be made of the right stuff. Now, quarks and particles that are made of quarks are the only types that can participate in the strong nuclear force. This is the strongest force in nature, the force that holds nuclei together. So, collectively, these particles are called hadrons, which is a Greek word. Now, there's another type of particle, which are called leptons, yet another Greek word. And these interact only weakly. And there are six types of these as well to match up with the six types of quarks. The most important lepton is the electron, which we've met before. And the other leptons are just brothers and sisters of this electron. And they all have Greek names. The electron's two brothers are called the muon and the tau, and its three sisters are the elusive neutrinos, the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. So with six quarks and six leptons, there are a total of 12 elementary or fundamental particles of matter. And altogether, we call those fermions in honor of one of the most important physicists of the 20th century, Enrico Fermi. Fermi was my dad's mentor. He taught my dad how to become a high-energy physicist, and he was my dad's PhD thesis advisor. As an aside, when I was an infant, we were all invited to the Fermis for dinner. I was set loose to crawl freely around the house, and they found me several minutes later chewing on pages I had ripped out of Fermi's physics books, which were lying about everywhere. My father was mortified at this sacrilege, but Fermi was a gentleman, and after biting his lip in frustration, he finally said, "Well, at least he has good taste." It seems my tastes have never changed, because I still enjoy devouring a good physics book. Now, we arrange the 12 fermions into three groups of four, three generations of four particles each, as is illustrated in image number 5. And again, the word generation is another fanciful name that really doesn't pertain to the normal English use of the word, because none of these particles is either the parent or the child of any of the other ones. Each generation contains a matched set of two quarks and two leptons. The first generation is the most important, as it contains the up and down quarks that make protons and neutrons, and it also contains the electron and its electron neutrino. So those particles are what create the atoms that we see in everything around us. The third generation particles are much heavier than the second generation, and those in turn are much heavier than the first generation particles. The heavier particles very rapidly disintegrate into the lighter particles of the first generation. Since the first generation particles are the lightest particles that exist, they can't disintegrate into anything else. This is because of the conservation of energy. So these particles in the first generation are stable, and they may indeed last forever. Because the second and third generation particles are so short-lived, they are almost never seen in nature, and seen only when we produce them in our laboratories. Another interesting characteristic of all fermions is that they are antisocial. That means that no two identical fermions will ever tolerate sharing the same state. Now, quantum mechanics tells us that a particle's state is the totality of its position, its velocity, and its spin. In fact, these little guys are like microscopic tops spinning around on their own axis. So two electrons can never be in the same place orbiting an atom in the same way with the same spin. And only because of this can atoms combine to form molecules, such as those that are essential to life. Thus, if fermions weren't stubbornly antisocial, life itself would not exist. So is that all there is? No, not quite yet. We still have to talk about antimatter and bosons. Antimatter is wild stuff, even wilder than science fiction, but it is, in fact, very real indeed. And it was the subject of my PhD thesis. Antimatter is like the alter ego of normal matter, the yin that goes with our yang. For every type of fermionic particle, for every quark and every lepton, there is a type of antiparticle. There is an anti-electron and an anti-up quark, etc. Two anti-ups and an anti-down make an antiproton, which has a negative electrical charge, opposite to the proton. Antiprotons are just like protons, but exactly the opposite. When a particle and an antiparticle come together, something very special happens. They annihilate. They completely destroy one another and leave behind only energy. No electric charge remains. There is no ash and no residue after the annihilation. There is only energy in the form of radiation. There is absolutely no trace left that the original particles ever existed. There's nothing for a CSI to examine. Absolutely nothing. We'll talk more about antimatter on another show. And lastly, we have the bosons. These are not particles of matter, nor are they particles of antimatter. These are the particles that carry the forces of nature. Our modern understanding of forces comes from a part of physics called quantum field theory. It says that the force between any two particles is simply the sum of all the forces between all the particles of one object with all the particles of the other object. This is like saying that all the phone calls between California and New York are the sum of everyone in California who's talking to somebody in New York. So far, this doesn't sound like a groundbreaking idea that might win a Nobel Prize. But the next step did, in fact, win a whole bunch of Nobel Prizes. That says that the force between two particles arises because the particles exchange a third type of particle called a boson. And this is illustrated on the right side of image number 6. So what's illustrated here is that you have a particle which is shown in yellow, and it zips along, and at one point it emits this wavy particle, which is the boson. And that wavy particle moves a distance and is then absorbed by another particle, which is shown in green. And because the yellow particle and the green particle have exchanged this boson, that creates a force between the two particles. So what are bosons? As seen in image number 6, each force of nature has its own set of bosons. The electromagnetic force, which is the combination of electricity and magnetism, and it's the force that holds atoms together, is caused by the exchange of photons, which are the particles of light. So indeed, light and electricity are, in a sense, really the same thing. The strong nuclear force that holds nuclei together is due to the exchange of a group of other bosons that are called gluons, and there are 8 of them. Gluons seems like a sort of silly name, inspired, if that's the right word, by the fact that the nuclear particles are held together so strongly that they seem to be superglued. There's another force called the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for radioactivity, and that comes from the exchange of another set of bosons called the W+, the W-, and the Z0. And again, the names really don't mean much, except that the plus, minus, and zero indicate the electric charges. Now, many believe that the force of gravity is due to the exchange of bosons, which are called gravitons. But no one has ever actually detected a graviton, so the jury's sort of still out on that one. And that's not what Einstein said in his general theory of relativity, which is our most accepted theory of gravity. The properties of the exchange bosons directly determine the properties of each of nature's 4 forces. So altogether, we have 13 bosons, if you count the graviton, which carry the forces between 12 fermions, which are the particles of matter, and 12 antifermions, that are the particles of antimatter. And all of this together is called the Standard Model of Particle Physics, a model that was completed about 40 years ago and hasn't changed very much at all since then. And one of the reasons it hasn't changed for the last 40 years is that in that time we haven't had a new particle accelerator with even higher energy to see if there are any heavier particles that exist than the ones that are in the Standard Model. So if you're not looking, you can't find anything new. Now, the $10 billion Large Hadronic Collider, called the LHC, is now coming up to speed in Geneva. It will be the first major accelerator in 40 years, and when it comes up to speed, it's going to deliver about 14 times as much energy as the previous accelerator. So that may create a whole new class of particles. Now, hopefully we'll discover some new and exciting physics, but if we don't discover anything new, that may be the last big physics machine that any government ever pays for. Thank you for tuning in today, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.